It's Livin' the Bream with host of Fox News at Night, Shannon Bream.
This week on Livin' the Bream podcast, we have someone that I have, is sort of a dream guest, somebody I've always wanted to come on and chat with us, and something tells me the listeners are going to want to hear this too. We have Molly Hemingway with us, senior editor at The Federalist, among many other things, and she has all kinds of things that we're going to talk about. Maybe she doesn't know, but we'll start off with some serious things. Molly, thank you for joining us.
It is great to be here with you.
You and I are doing this just after having wrapped Special Report together, and there were a lot of big news stories to talk about today. I think this is interesting. We're in the middle of figuring out whether there's going to be a shutdown or not. The Senate has given its volley. It now goes to the House. But there were a lot of funding things that the Republicans have talked about not giving money for, like Planned Parenthood, some other Obamacare things. My understanding is a lot of that money is included in this deal.
Yeah, I believe that's correct. And this all broke hours ago. So we'll have to see what happens when it comes to the end of the day. But I think this is incredibly frustrating for a lot of Republican voters, that they're told that they need to give power to the Republican Party so that they can do things like finally stop funding the largest abortion corporation in the country. And then when they get all that power, they don't actually do what you should do there. And it's not like there aren't means to even do this without changing funding issues. Like, you could give the same amount of funding or even more funding to community health centers that have a broader array of services. So there's, you know, it's just frustrating to see the lack of political will there when the voters have been promised something that they keep not getting.
Well, it's interesting because you think about the first couple of years of the Obama administration. They did have the House and Senate, and they didn't do immigration then. So what is it about parties that make a lot of campaign promises, and then when they're in control, just like the Republicans who voted how many times to completely repeal Obamacare, and then when they got in power, some of those same people stopped voting for it?
This is what I think is the most interesting aspect of the political dynamic that gave us Trump, which is both parties figured out that you could exploit voter sentiment and not solve problems and keep people angry and agitating, and that this would work out well for the parties, but it wouldn't actually match the voters' interests. And I think what you're seeing on both sides of the aisle is voters are just getting sick and tired of this. They're sick of being played, and they are wanting to see dramatic change with how things are done in Washington, and they're willing to do pretty extreme things to get that.
You think that's why they elected Donald Trump?
I think it's a big part of it, just a frustration with the entire system, or a belief that the system is somehow corrupted. And they have good reason to think that, again, on both sides of the aisle. And immigration is a great example. It'll be interesting to see what happens at the end of the day. But you have all the makings of a fix of the thing that Democrats claim they really want, legalization or even citizenship for a certain sort of favorable class mm-hmm. of people who are...
Almost 2 million.
Right. And yet they might not get it because they do understand this is a really good voter issue mm-hmm. for their base. And so we'll have to see if they actually do what they claim is the right thing or not. But you see it again on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah, I read a really interesting piece last week. It may have been the New York Times, where they compiled many different people, professors, sociologists, political strategists, who talked about, does President Trump have Democrats in a corner now with this deal where he's saying, hey, I'm going to give you 2 million people. That's not even what you asked for. We were discussing 700,000 people. Now I'm talking about even the ones who didn't come forward and register. I'm going to give you all that, but you do have to agree to some of the security border and the chain migration, this, that, and the other. And these sociologists and professors were talking about, for Democrats, it's so tough because do they say to the Dreamers, nope, we chose chain migration and visa lottery over you. We wouldn't make this deal because of those things. Or do they continue to cater to a very specific base when independents are going to say, why are you so interested in helping these people instead of me?
So one of the things I also think is interesting about the larger immigration debate is it used to be an issue that got certain people on either side of the issue really excited, but they were fairly small groups of people on either side of the issue. And now, as it becomes this major thing that a lot of people are thinking about and studying and whatnot, you're starting to see a change in voter opinion that I believe people used to think that a lot of rethinking of our immigration policy was something that was just a non-starter and wasn't going to happen. And now we're seeing polls come out that show, in fact, people would like a much lower level of immigration. They absolutely want fundamental reforms of the type that lead to merit-based immigration, like what Canada and Australia have. And all of a sudden, this ground that people thought was very favorable to Democrats might not be so favorable to Democrats. But yes, it is a difficult position that Democrats are in. But also, if Democrats took Donald Trump up on this offer, which a lot of people think was way too generous for his base, mm-hmm. he could be in a tough bind. So mm-hmm. it's a little bit of a tricky game here.
Yeah, because we hear from a lot of folks over in the House, a more conservative side, who they're just using the word amnesty and saying, well, I don't understand this. Why are we, you know, and then we have this proposal that comes out this week from Senators McCain and Coons, which doesn't even give you the border wall. It says, we'll study it for a year.
Yeah, there was,
I mean, what they know he's never going to go for that. So what is the point?
I don't know. I saw last week at that Republican retreat in West Virginia, Senator John Thune said something like, maybe we'll just get a little bit of border security and a DACA fix. And I was thinking, that is so not where the mood of the country is right now, where people are thinking we finally need to address some of these major issues. Obviously, the country is a lot different than it has been in previous decades. And there are these structural issues with our immigration, and there are ways to improve it. And, you know, immigration is such a good thing, and it's such a healthy thing for a country. But having it be sort of reckless or mindless or random is not a healthy way to approach immigration. There are all sorts of issues economically, security, and otherwise that need to be brought into this. It would be so nice to see people actually work together, given these competing interests, but we'll have to see. On the other hand, they just maybe you just need to give them an opportunity to spend a lot of money, because they came together on the Senate, on the budget, by deciding that if both sides get to spend a lot of money, they can work together. So maybe that's the fix.
Yeah, that seemed to be the conclusion thus far in the Senate, for sure. So many other hot topics and stories going on in D.C. So let's talk about where we are with the memos back and forth, because at the time we're recording this, the Democrats' memo is sitting at the White House, apparently waiting for the president's decision about what to do with it. And we're told there are some who say Adam Schiff and the Democrats filled this with all kinds of material that can never go public, and so he's going to have to redact some things, and then he turns in a memo to the public that's got black lines all through it, and people say, aha, what is that? And Schiff openly talking about, we don't want redactions that are political in nature. Is it a trap, or is that the right overblowing it? And this is a legitimate memo. The White House says it's going to go through the same process and the same considerations.
Well, it is going through the same process, in that the House Intelligence Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence voted to let the entire House see it, and then they voted to make it public, and they're going through the same review process at the White House, which also enables the Department of Justice and FBI to review and demand any retractions or whatnot that they might feel the need to. Adam Schiff is like my favorite conspiracy theorist, and he is delightful to watch, and he's frequently on television and talking about his
we've invited him many times onto Fox News at Night. The invitation stands.
But, you know, his perspective is a little hard to understand. First off, he said that there was no way the Republican memo should have been released because it compromised sources and methods, and it was a threat to national security, and the American people couldn't handle the truth. Well, then it came out. It obviously didn't compromise national security. It didn't have anything on sources or methods, unless the source and method is buying information from the Hillary Clinton campaign that's not true. But other than that, I don't think there were any sources and methods. And so then he comes up with his own memo, which we hear is just packed with actual stuff that might not be made public. But I kind of think, at this point, people just need to know what's going on. And what's the big threat? Like, maybe he did do that, and maybe it's time to call people's bluff. Every Democrat is saying, you have to release this Democrat memo. Well, do it. And let's see what's in there. And let's, like, the people have been jerked around sort of by so many different people here that I think the time has come for just a lot of transparency. And that includes the FISA applications themselves. Just all sorts of things that people have a right to know about, so they can trust their FBI and Department of Justice. And that's the ultimate goal, that you do want to have healthy law enforcement agencies.
Yeah. And what do you think when we get the Democrat memo? Because a lot of folks say, listen, what you've seen in the Nunes memo is out of context. McCabe didn't say that, or he said it in a different way. Do you think that once it's out, kind of the pendulum will swing the other way, and then we'll balance back to the middle where, okay, we have the facts on all sides, and now we can see what really happened. Everybody includes their information, and now we can make a more informed decision.
I kind of think we're at the beginning of a very long process, and part of that will require people on multiple sides to come out with their case. And it also means that we have to have some kind of independent investigation where it's not so partisan.
Is that possible?
I mean, a special counsel would be possible. If you did that would be a good way.
But even there, you know, there are people who are after Mueller all the time. Oh, look at his people that he's put together. They're all Democratic donors, or they've worked for Democratic.
I'm just saying, theoretically, folks, it's possible to run a special counsel investigation. One of the big problems with the House and Senate committees that have been investigating this is they've been unable to get compliance from the FBI and DOJ. Mm-hmm. It has taken so much to get them to just turn over information. And these are their overseeing authorities. Congress oversees these agencies, but they sometimes act like they oversee Congress, and they get to determine what gets seen and what doesn't get seen. So we've heard a lot about a Russia conspiracy theory. I can't imagine what we hear that we haven't kind of heard the outlines of, but maybe we'll know more about why they have this elaborate Russia collusion treason theory, and we can dig into those things. The one thing that's really troublesome, I think, is that we do not have a very curious media establishment. Like, this is the scandal of the century. There's so many interesting things. They're very interested on the one side of that Russia theory. And they have explored every nook and cranny, and they have taken every leak from Schiff and his team that you could possibly take and run with it, and the Fusion GPS people. It would be nice to see some similar interest on the other side of, gee, did these courts handle things properly? Should you be investigating a presidential campaign? Did it start on the up and up? Why were Clinton people feeding information to the dossier author who was feeding it back to the FBI? These are really interesting questions. And then also what happened today, where some of these texts talked about President Obama being briefed on an investigation, and apparently people close to the people doing those texts said that was in fact about the Russian meddling investigation, which is another name for the Trump investigation. And so finding out when President Obama first knew about that investigation and what his briefings entailed and whether he understood that the Clinton campaign was part of this, you know, that's all very interesting. And I would like reporters to ask President Obama about that and anyone else who might be involved.
Well, you know, he has been revered as many presidents are right when they leave office. It tends to be, you know, history shows that the people like them more and more the longer that they're gone. But the minute he left, he was treated in a way that was, you know, a statesman. He served 8 years. He oversaw a lot of important things that happened in our country, and people immediately wanted to almost deify him. As often happens with former leaders, once they're not in office, there's less space to criticize them. But do you think even at this point, if he sits down and does interviews with Prince Harry or whoever it is, he could be getting more interesting questions?
I think that perhaps you would see a continuation of what happened during his presidency, which is a media establishment that was very interested in protecting him more than asking tough questions. And in fact, I think that's part of the problem with this larger story that's developing out of the Russia collusion narrative of perhaps wrongdoing at the FBI and DOJ, which is, it has always been a story that has kind of marginally touched on Obama, whether it's the fact that Obama knew Hillary Clinton had a private email set up and kind of gave some conflicting information about that, or that he signaled that he thought she should be let go because she didn't have intent, which is precisely what Comey said publicly when he let her go. You know, there are all these things that kind of touch on Obama, and a big important truth for a lot of journalists is that, this is their version of truth, is that Obama had a scandal-free presidency. And even though you know that's not true because you know about all these other scandals
that
happened,
that's
something they feel very invested in. And so I think it's keeping them from just doing the normal digging that you would.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's fair, the treatment that the president gets from the press often, because they say he's not being truthful, that he over-exaggerates everything, that they have to stand there and fact-check him and his administration because he's not telling the American people the truth. And they say the media is to be a check on a leader who wants to do things that are inappropriate and unconstitutional.
Well, that is absolutely true that the media should be speaking truth to power and being a check on people who don't tell the truth. And President Trump has had for decades a very fast and loose relationship with the truth, and he's hyperbolic and he exaggerates. And all this is true that the media should hold him to account. The problem is that they lost the public trust by not holding the previous administration to account and by not doing due diligence on that presidency, you know, asking questions like, what has enchanted you the most about the presidency versus, is it true that you're mentally insane? You know, these are not equivalent questions. Mm-hmm. And the reaction that they have had to Trump from the campaign, you know, the primary campaign, the general campaign, and then his presidency is so abnormal that I don't think that enough reporters are thinking through what this does to their credibility, the credibility of the journalistic profession, and how, I don't even know what you do to go to get that trust with average people back.
Also, another announcement today that Eric Holder's not running, ruling out running for president. What do you think about the idea of a president Holder?
I saw you announce that on Special Report, and I was like, what in the world? I mean, I guess the Democrats don't have a particularly strong bench, and this is kind of exciting that you can have a free-for-all for this. And I don't know. I mean, it was so shocking to me that someone like Holder would say this, that I haven't given proper thought to it. So I will wait.
Okay, we'll leave it there. All I know is that Senator Kamala Harris is probably not happy.
She's probably.
Because she's like, whoa, hey, I got to get rid of Cory Booker. I got to get that nomination. I don't need any more people throwing their names in who are household names.
A lot of people think the Republican mess of 2016 was just horrific and it was horrible for the party. And I get that. But there was also something really exciting and interesting about it. So I kind of like the idea that Democrats would have a similar, you know, 18-person primary. Mm-hmm. That primary they had was super boring, and it was rigged. You know, like there was no way that anyone but
Bernie.
Hillary would get it. So I hope for Democratic voters they do get some excitement.
I talked to a lot of Bernie bros at the DNC who were very unhappy. Of course, all that stuff is breaking about Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the emails and all that kind of stuff. They were not happy.
They may be, you know, communists, but they had a point. He was not being treated
They were
fairly.
Very lovable. I got to tell you that. Okay, so I got to ask you, you have an economics degree. How did you end up where you are now?
Oh.
Did you think you would? Because I didn't think I'd be doing what I'm doing.
I definitely didn't think I would be doing anything like what I'm doing. And I thought my whole growing up and throughout college and whatnot that I knew I wanted to be an econ professor, and then figured out shortly after I got my BA that, in fact, I didn't want to be an econ professor. And it was really just a period of confusion. And all my friends who were reporters, they made no money, but they loved what they were doing and they had different things they worked on each day. And I thought, you know what, this could work. So I'm glad I changed into journalism, and it's been a fun line of work ever since.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got to tell you, one of the pieces that made me think that we could be friends when you wrote it was about Mike Pence, when everybody was having a meltdown over the fact that he had sort of some guidelines that he and his wife have, stuck to, that he doesn't dine alone with another woman, and if there's alcohol, he wants her to be there with him, and that kind of thing. And it didn't sound weird to me at all, only because my husband and I operate very much in that same space. I mean, we have trusted friends and of the opposite sex and that kind of thing, but listen, the world's full of temptation, and you would think he was an axe murderer the way this was being portrayed. You know, people talking about Sharia law and all these other kinds of things, and I thought, wow, this world is sort of upside down when we're saying somebody is so concerned about fidelity to his marriage that he set up some rules that people think are, you know, so archaic. And I just thought your piece was a good take on that.
That moment was insane. And it's a good reminder that what you're seeing among reporters or on social media doesn't match reality, because the New York Times had a story shortly thereafter, or maybe it was like even a year later, showing they had a poll showing that people actually totally support Pence rules when it comes to
their marriages,
making sure your marriage is solid.
Yeah.
And so you realize how out of touch a lot of the people who control our discourse are. And I'm not saying everybody has to have the same rules, but my husband and I absolutely have rules, and we have a very happy marriage, mm-hmm. funnily enough, you know. And in the latest news that came out about all these, you know, assaults and everything, horrible workplace behavior, I think that Mike Pence was completely vindicated, as are all people who value their marriage and their spouses enough to treat them with respect.
Can I tell you what made me laugh in your article is when you referenced knocking boots? Because that is, to me, is just such a funny saying anyway. But you were talking about in a marriage, like, that's a healthy, important thing.
Yes.
And that when you make each other happy and you pay attention to each other, spouses need that and they appreciate it. But that phrase just for some reason made me laugh.
And isn't it funny? You know, we have so much talk about sex outside of marriage, but we don't think about the importance of having healthy, active marriages and how much love between spouses nurtures happy homes and families.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought the piece was, it made me laugh, but it made me think, and I think it made a lot of people think as well. Okay, now I also found out that you used to be a DJ.
Mm-hmm.
What the heck?
I mean, I have always really liked music, and in college I did some DJing and I really enjoyed it. But like the only legacy of that is that I have a very extensive vinyl record collection of like many thousands of albums.
Wow, thousands!
That's still how I listen to my music. And my husband, when we got married, he just thought I was so weird. It's not that it was mostly that I just am a sort of conservative person, and I started listening to music on vinyl, and I never changed to the new technologies. Mm-hmm. And I like vinyl. I like the way it sounds. I like the album art. Yeah. I like everything. And I like the practice of hunting for new records and whatnot. So, so I love
so
vinyl
music.
So
did you like skip 8-tracks and mm-hmm. cassettes and all that, and just that none of that?
NCDs, you know, and like
well, CDs are going away apparently now. I'm like, listen, I still have a bag of cassettes that every time we move, I take them with me, and I kept a boombox from the 1990s because it has a cassette player in it. Every time we've moved, my husband's like, really? I think it's time we get rid of
that.
You
know
what?
I'm
like, no way.
I heard cassettes are coming back, and in fact, they sell them at like those, you know, hipster stores, and kids
look, I'm the least hip person I know,
and kids are now doing it and listening to it, and you can get, you know, and I do notice that when I go shopping for the vinyl that mm-hmm. they're bigger cassette tape collections.
I cannot believe that.
I can't either because it's really not a great way to listen to music.
It is not a great way.
Although the portability and the coolness of just holding your boombox there.
I mean, I'm going to start walking around with it because it takes 18D batteries. And I think I can put that thing on my shoulder. Then I can have my little piece of cardboard and put it down and be able to break dance with it because all my cassettes are from the 80s.
I would pay money to see that. So that sounds like a great idea.
Maybe we'll find a good charity. That would be a way to do it. And I'll rope you in too. Molly, thank you so much for visiting with us on Live in the Bream. It's been great to have you as our guest.
Thank you so much.